This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome. I'm Tommy Bruce, and I'm happy to welcome you to the ninth online conversation with David Skorton. This is an exciting online conversation because we're actually doing this. This is a field trip, and we're actually at the Weill Medical College in New York City. I'm here with President David Skorton, who I don't know if everybody can see this, but he's still wearing his identification. And I'm wondering, did you just were you just visiting patients today at the hospital?
You know, this isn't a very good prop because I'm getting used to the webcam. It's not Skype, but it's something sort of like Skype. I am my primary academic appointment, as I know you know, is in internal medicine and also in pediatrics. And really, it's the only thing I do that I'm trained to do. You don't have to comment on that.
Well, I think the patients must be lining up outside. Let me just do one quick little house cleaning. Of course, if you remember that if you want to ask a question of President Skorton, there's a little hand waver at the bottom, the left corner of your screen. Click on that, and that will signal that you're ready to talk to us. If you cannot, and you're not on the telephone, but you still want to ask us a question, you're welcome to send us a message through the chat window, and I'll be monitoring that during the course of this conversation. So with no further ado, I'd like to invite President Skorton to make a few opening remarks, and then we'll take questions from you out there.
Thanks, Tommy, and welcome, everyone. This is our first field trip. It's our ninth online conversation. Tommy has taught me the word webinar. Apparently, that's what this is. And we're at the medical center, and we're here for the reason that I spend about a quarter of my time in New York City. I wanted to say a couple of things very quickly about Cornell's presence in New York City, Tommy, if I might, as well as about the medical center. Of course, virtually everyone associated with Cornell is aware of and very proud of the Weill Cornell Medical Center. I'm proud as my area of academic focus, and I am doing a little tiny bit of teaching and seeing a very occasional consultation in congenital heart disease in adolescents and adults. Besides the Weill Cornell Medical College, I want to remind everyone that we have program offices on Broad Street in Operations Research and Information Engineering, on 17th Street for Architecture, on 34th Street, I think, Tommy, is, if I'm not mistaken, Cooperative Extension or near
there,
and Industrial Labor Relations Extension. Human Ecology is in Manhattan. We have an Alumni Affairs and Development Office that just opened at on 45th. And, of course, Weill Cornell Medical College and Cornell Cooperative Extension, which is in every county in the state in all five boroughs.
And I would just add that if you want to know more about Cornell's presence in New York City, you can go to the website, cornell.edu. You'll see a very recognizable New York City landscape button, and just click on that and take your website that lays it all out.
So we've been spending a lot of time on these online conversations talking about the fiscal health of the university, and we've suffered from the recession, but we're on the way toward a balanced budget, quite a ways on the way. Weill Cornell Medical College, where we are now, has a balanced budget, has a very slight surplus, in fact, and the Ithaca campus is down to a deficit in the $60 million range on a base of $2 billion. So we're doing a good job in getting there. One of the really exciting things that's happening is strategic planning across the whole university, including Weill Cornell, and there is an 8-faculty council developing a strategic plan. The draft outline for the plan is on the website, just as Tommy has set up this very, very informative website. Right on our webpage is a link called Reimagining Cornell, and if you go on Reimagining Cornell, you can see all the things that are going on. And on Reimagining Cornell, Tommy, I know, is the draft outline for the strategic plan, which is terrific. One of the exciting things that's happening here in Manhattan at the medical college is that we're going to build a new research building that will help both Weill Cornell Medical College and Ithaca and the activities that go between the two campuses in biomedical engineering and many other areas. And that building will be on 69th between York and First, and we'll all be watching this magnificent structure rise over the next couple of years. One other thing I want to mention to my colleagues in medical and also those who may be listening who are not physicians is that a lot of our thoughts and prayers have recently been with our colleagues and friends and neighbors in Haiti. And I believe medical graduates would know this, but just in case, Cornell set up the first general AIDS clinic in the world in Port-au-Prince in 1979, set up by Dr. Jean Pop, who is a Weill Cornell graduate, a Haitian physician, and we've been there for 30-plus years. We lost four colleagues out of a staff of 350 during the earthquakes, and the whole university, Ithaca and Weill Cornell, are coming together to decide how Cornell can participate not only in the immediate relief, medical and humanitarian relief, but also in rebuilding Haiti. So a lot of exciting things going on at your alma mater, and very, very much appreciate you being with us today, and I'm ready to field your questions. Thank you. And Tommy, I'm ready.
So while we're waiting for further some questions here, I was wondering, David, if you could talk a little bit about the excitement that's been going on around with the basketball team.
Sure.
Do you have any firsthand, as somebody who's come from a university where sports were quite important, how does it feel to be here in the midst of all this craziness around our basketball team?
Tommy, I'm shocked to hear you say that. Well, I am at a university right now where sports is quite important, and men's basketball, but many other sports. He's baiting me, folks. That's okay. Anyway, for the first time in 59 years, men's basketball was nationally ranked. For a couple of weeks, we were 25th at the ESPN USA Today poll, then we were 22nd, and then we lost to Penn. But we're still doing terrifically well. I think right now we're 8-1 in the Ivies, or is it 9-1?
9-1.
And we had a wonderful article in the New York Times on the front page of the sports section about Steve Donohue and about the terrific team players and coaches on the basketball team. So a lot of exciting things going on around here. And we hope to be at the NCAAs real soon.
Absolutely. I'm sort of also wondering, since you were doing your rounds this morning, if you could talk a little bit about Weill Medical College and what do you see happening here, and,
yeah.
And what are your firsthand experiences like?
So I wasn't actually doing rounds this morning, just to set the record straight, but I am in the Department of Medicine and Pediatrics, and we'll be doing a little teaching and a few patient activities. But I'm very, very, very proud to be linked as a faculty member at Weill Cornell and to have consulting privileges at New York Presbyterian Hospital. As you know, New York Presbyterian Hospital is one of the very most highly ranked healthcare organizations in the United States. I believe, Tommy, in the last rankings of hospitals, New York Presbyterian was number 6 in the United States. And one of the main campuses, of course, is on the Upper East Side with Weill Cornell Medical College. And it's very, very exciting. And as a patient care and medical education enterprise, Weill Cornell and New York Presbyterian Hospital, previously New York Hospital, have for a long time been at the very, very top echelon of institutions. On the other hand, it's important to note that we have a small class at Weill Cornell, about 100 students per year getting MDs, and a small faculty. And so in research productivity per faculty, it's very, very high at Weill Cornell, but in aggregate productivity, because the faculty is relatively small, it's not large. And that's the reason, as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that we're building this medical research building on 69th in order to increase the space available to allow us to recruit and retain more physician scientists and other scientists to bring the research potential into fruition at Weill Cornell.
I see that we have our first question coming online right there.
That's great.
Dr. Skorton, can you provide an update on the status of the dual degree MD-MBA program?
You know, I don't have any very recent updates to share with you. I believe that you are a graduate of that program. I think that's right. And it's a very, very exciting opportunity. Being in medicine for over 30 years, I've had colleagues who have done MD, MBA, MD, MPH. separate degrees, and even one physician who did an MD and then got a Master's of Public Administration. And it's wonderful that we have a program. I will get updated on it in the, I believe, 4 or 5 years since you, Ed, have graduated. And Tommy will get back to you. I do want to say one thing about the MD as a manager or leader. I found there's obviously not too many MDs who are presidents of research universities. There's been some very distinguished ones. Bill Brody, for many years, president of Johns Hopkins. Ed Hundert at Case Western Reserve, and a couple of others. But I think some of the skills we learn as physicians actually translate really well into management. One is the fact that we often have to make decisions under conditions of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You do that all the time as a physician. Perhaps the most important thing is that you learn that the first rule of communication is to listen when the patient comes in the office or in the clinic. So I think it's very, very useful to have that degree. And I'm sorry I don't have on the tip of my tongue any specific updates or changes on this combined program, but we'll get back to you. Thanks for being here today.
I see that, I thought that Gene Resnick was going to ask a question there, but in the meantime, it was just while we're waiting for our... Go ahead.
Is it
Gene, are you online? Go ahead.
I am. Is it working?
Yes, it is, Gene. We're just turning the volume up. It's good to hear your voice. How are you?
Hey. Hi, David and Tommy. David, let me applaud your accessibility, first of all, and use of technology to keep us all green. Some of us old folks need to catch up with you when it comes to using technology.
Well, I'll tell you, Gene, I think you know that I'm playing catch-up to Tommy Bruce, but thank you for giving me credit for Tommy's idea. I like that.
I have a question to follow up on something you just mentioned. AAMC has projected variably between 70,000 and 100,000 physician shortage in the next 10 or 15 years. And there's been some discussion about that in the setting of healthcare reform. Do you see any change or impact on Weill Cornell's class size related to that?
Well, first of all, Gene, I know you and I both lived through the sort of roller coaster set of expert opinions about whether there are too many physicians, just the right number, or too few. I know that you remember maybe a decade or a little bit more ago that we were told that we were going to have a huge surplus of physicians, and we were asked to shrink medical class sizes. At the institution I was at, we very substantially reduced the class size in response to that call for action. And then just as you very correctly and astutely noted, now in the last couple, 3 years, we've been told that we're going to have a big shortfall of physicians and we should expand. It's hard to expand in Manhattan because of the landlocked nature of space. We do have a beautiful new building going up, Medical Research Building. The issue has been raised. I know that Provost Gatto and the Overseers, Board of Overseers, and you and others, alumni and members of the faculty, have considered it and are considering it. No immediate plans for any large-scale increases right now. One other thing that Weill Cornell does is do medical education and research through the Methodist Hospital in Houston. It's another way of reaching out and expanding, multiplying the effort of the faculty. But this is a very, very critical issue, not only the issue of how many physicians should be educated and trained, but exactly what the mix of specialties should be, primary care versus specialties and what specialties, the whole issue of hospitalists and so on. All these things are in play. So stay tuned. We're thinking about it here as well. No immediate plans for any large expansion. But thanks for the question, Gene. And thanks for sharing
thanks,
with us today.
I see that Reza Shapiro is wanting to ask a question. Reza, can you speak now and ask your question?
Yes, I think I'm live now. Good afternoon.
Hi. Please go ahead.
I'm a graduate of Ag and Life in 99 and also a PhD from the Weill Graduate School in 2005, and it's really nice to see how many increased connections there have been between the Ithaca campus and New York City in the past few years. It's not always apparent that those connections extend to the Weill Graduate School. Even though we're formally part of the medical college, it's really a very different program, environment, set of administration, and really what's available to those students. I think two of the biggest examples would be the availability of a strong alumni network and also career services. And I think there are probably some simple ways to connect those students with the Ithaca resources that would both enhance student life and also be a great recruiting tool. Are there things going on behind the scenes that you can talk to from the Weill Graduate School perspective?
Sarisa, this is a really, really important question, and it's close to my heart for two reasons. One is that with my background, not on the PhD side, but in medical research, I very much am interested in combining forces between the campuses. Secondly, as you may know, my wife is a professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine and at Weill Cornell Medical College and has very active research laboratories both in New York City and in Ithaca. She's a PhD molecular biologist and neuroscientist. And so by watching her progress since we moved to Cornell, I have gotten firsthand knowledge of the strengths and areas where we could improve the graduate student experience on both campuses. So we are talking about some things. I'm in the listening mode to the students. Since I've been here, I've had a couple of sort of town hall meetings, I guess you could call them, one oriented toward the graduate students and then another one oriented toward MDs. Also, when I have meetings with student leaders, elected student leaders, I know you're probably aware, Risa, perhaps you even were an elected student leader, that there are elected student leaders of those in the Graduate School of Medical Sciences as well as elected student leaders on the MD side and a student elected overseer as well. And so when I have periodic every several week meetings in Ithaca with student leaders of the undergraduate, graduate, and professional students in Ithaca, we always invite the elected leaders of the Graduate School of Medical Sciences and Weill Cornell MD programs to those discussions. And just was talking the other day after an overseer's meeting with Jeff Russ, who's the current student elected overseer, about re-energizing the interactions to get at issues just like you're talking about. Also, the strategic planning that's going on is going to focus on student experience, both curricular and non-curricular broadly, and this is an area of a very important focus for us. I wish I could give you some more concrete progress to report on, but all I can tell you so far is awareness and good intentions and some early attempts to listen. But I am aware of it, and it's actually very close because of my background and because of things I've learned by watching my wife's activities on both campuses. Risa, if you have ideas about this, in addition to the good ones that you just mentioned, and you don't mind taking a few minutes, will you write an email directly to me? It's david.scorton@cornell.edu, david.scorton@cornell.edu, and I'll read it myself, of course, and I'll also share it with David Hadjar and with Sonny Power, the Graduate College Dean in Ithaca, and we'll keep pushing hard on this, a very important issue. Thank you.
Great. I'd be happy to send that email.
Good. I'll be looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Gerald Mandel is waving his hand and ready to ask a question. Gerald, would you please ask your question?
Yeah, hi, President Scorton. I have a quick comment and two questions. And the first comment is disappointment with the fact that in order to register for this conversation, that credit card was asked for, which doesn't sound right, but I know. Second question, next is a question. First, why was the Presbyterian New York Hospital merger done, and how is it going? And the third question is, I'd like to hear some remarks about our Qatar experience.
Sure. Forgive me for being ignorant, but I wasn't aware about the credit card. Tommy, did you know about that?
No, I got to say I'm a little bit surprised, and I'm going to, before you end the second question, I'll have an answer to the first one.
Okay, so we'll look into that. Thank you for making me aware of it, and I apologize, I didn't know that. In terms of the interaction between the campuses, is that what you're asking in terms of the merger?
Yeah, first, why was it done? And secondly, you know, what's happening?
Okay. I'm not sure at the original time why it was done. Obviously, it was a decision of the hospital and the hospital's board. We don't own and operate New York Presbyterian, and I'm sorry that I'm not aware those so many years ago why they decided to do that. There is a lot of interaction between the two campuses in areas, pediatrics and in other areas. And as I know you know, the combined hospital, New York Presbyterian, is very, very highly ranked and one of the very best overall organizations run by Herb Pardes, a physician himself, who's the CEO of the whole operation. Interactions between the two campuses themselves, the medical school, depends in the area that you're talking about, and there are many research linkages at the faculty-to-faculty level and some clinical linkages as well. In terms of your question about Qatar, I've been paying close attention to that for a variety of reasons. I'm going this year for the third time to give the MDs at that commencement in Doha. And I've organized a meeting with the presidents of the other five schools that are part of a so-called Education City. On the medical side, we're having very good success attracting students to come to this unusual program, which is a seven-year program. We are having very good luck with them performing during medical school days, statistically indistinguishable from students in the New York City campus who have the identical curriculum. And thirdly, we've had very good success so far, that is, the students have had good success gaining residencies through the matching program in the United States, those who want to come to the U.S., which has been the vast majority. And they've gotten very good residencies in some of the finest institutions in the country, including at New York Presbyterian. So those things are moving along. The initial emphasis of Weill Cornell Medical College in Qatar has been on education. The next step is research, and we have set up some research laboratories to bring that very important facet of academic life to the docs and PhDs in Doha. And then thirdly, the government is building a new digital hospital. SIDRA is the name of the complex. And we will be very heavily involved in staffing various specialties in SIDRA. They're going to have an emphasis on pediatrics and maternal and child care and obstetrics. And so that's a quick once over. If you want to have more information on this, drop me just a quick email, and I'll have someone send you a sort of a written summary of all these three items that you asked about. Tommy, any news on Dr. Mandel's issue about the credit card?
Yeah, so what I was going to say is that there's obviously some mistake, Jerry Mandel. Please, I don't think you will be charged. You should not have been charged and should not have been asked for a credit card. But if some charge should appear, please contact me directly, and I'll work this out with you. I'm Tommy Bruce, all in one word, at Cornell.edu. I'd be happy to resolve this confusion. While we're waiting for questions to come up, David, I was wondering if you might want to sort of expand a little bit more about some of the efforts that you have encouraged of convergence between the two campuses in the research area, the Weill Hall and so forth, and other things that you might see in the offing.
Sure. Well, first, let's give credit to those who came before who really got this rolling over the last decade, Biddy Martin, provost at that time in Ithaca, and Tony Gatto, provost at Weill Cornell Medical College. They set up, through David Hadjar's good offices, a seed grant program the funds could be accessed by investigators who were working together across the two campuses. And getting back to Risa's excellent point and excellent area of focus, a lot of that had to do with people sharing a research interest, often with a graduate student, either having co-mentorship or some access to faculty and postdoc and graduate student resources on both campuses. Those several hundred thousand dollars of seed grants produced a many times over return on investment, if I could use that term, in external funding. And so that was the first step. Secondly, Weill Hall and the new medical research building, Weill Hall in Ithaca and the new medical research building in New York City that's just beginning to be built, both have a focus, both the one at Weill Hall and the one here will have a focus on accommodating work that brings the campuses together. The Department of Biomedical Engineering in the very highly rated Cornell University College of Engineering in Ithaca has that focus. I'm a faculty member in biomedical engineering, and it's breathtakingly impressive faculty. And I guess the proof of the pudding that people think it's worthwhile is that physicians from this medical center on multiple occasions have left New York City and gone for retreats between here in Ithaca or in Ithaca in order to get together with biomedical engineers and others in Ithaca and vice versa. So some of this has been initial pilot projects. Some of it has been the brick and mortar that we're putting together to facilitate linkages. Some people like my wife, Robin Davison, actually have joint appointments and do things on both campuses. There's not a lot of people that I know about who actually have labs in both cities, but there's more and more activity. Obviously, the 240 miles is a fearsome obstacle. As you and I have talked about so many times, Tommy, if there was light rail service between the city and Ithaca, it would make things a lot better. But we do have a fleet of buses that you and I both ride quite frequently, and we do our best to eliminate that distance. In some of the cases, Gene Resnick was giving me credit for this technology, which is hilarious, since I don't know anything about it even today. But I know that in the two labs that my wife and her colleagues interact on, they do, Matt is here, what, every other day approximately, a video conference back and forth where they have some program. I don't know much about this. Matt, what's it called?
It's a Polycom machine.
Polycom machine where they can have multiple windows on the computer and they can be looking at data, slides, you know, each other, word slides, whatever. And so we are using technology to try to vanish some of that distance. But there's a lot going on and a lot more that will happen when these two structures are finished.
Before we go to Cal Bender's question, I thought it would be because we have a lot of docs on with us today, they'd be interested to know that this convergence between the two campuses is extended to the Cayuga Medical Center as well, where while students are tell them a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so
exciting development.
It's full circle of having you know, the pre-medical, preclinical days used to be taught in Ithaca many, many moons ago. And now, because of the work of physicians here at Weill Cornell, especially Andy Schaefer, the chair of the Department of Medicine, and Adam Law, who at the time was the elected head of the medical staff at Cayuga Medical Center in Ithaca, we have, just as Tommy said, medical students from Weill Cornell going up to interacting with private practitioners, especially in primary care disciplines in Ithaca and Tompkins County. And I understand residents from internal medicine are going to be going up to Cayuga Medical Center. I've also recently been given the honor of consulting privileges at that medical center and am be able to watch firsthand to see this linkage. And it's wonderful. Tommy, I think you're still on the board of Cayuga Medical Center, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. I am.
It's a lot of linkages among these three institutions.
Absolutely. So thank you, David. Carol Bender, I had her was waving to get attention here.
Okay.
Carol, are you on? And
I'm on.
And would you like to ask a question?
I would. This is for Dr. Skorton, his physician side. I am one of those in primary care, an internist. I sat on the licensing board in the state of Maryland. I was one of the best internists in the area, and I quit. I quit when I made $60,000, taking no plans. My colleagues and I are all quitting. So I submit there may not be a shortage of physicians. What there is a shortage of is people caring that physicians earn a decent living. Doctors are being paid $60 an hour for primary care internists, while nurse practitioners and PAs are being paid $50 an hour. But my question, and I appreciate you listening to my prelude, and this is a little bit of a prelude, the Mayo Clinic said they would drop Medicare if the age was lowered to 55. Within several hours, the federal government dropped the idea of dropping Medicare eligibility to 55. Since you graduate a lot of medical students with debts as high as $150,000 or more, and a lot of undergraduates who go into medicine who may not have the privilege of going to your medical school and mine, I would like to respectfully suggest that Cornell, Columbia, the other medical students start to use their bully pulpits to see that we are paid decent wages, so that I would love nothing better than to donate $25,000 to Cornell every year. I was making $150,000 20 years ago. Medicare has not raised their $66 reimbursement in 20 years, and I am begging you, with other presidents of universities, presidents of medical schools, to please be the bully pulpit as the Mayo Clinic was.
Well, first of all, thanks for bringing it up. You may or may not know about my background. I was the head of general medicine at the University of Iowa for some years and ran a primary care operation, primary care internal medicine, not family medicine operation, at quite a large facility there. Faced a lot of these issues and have been active through other organizations, not a primary care organization, but through the American College of Cardiology on reimbursement issues for over 20 years. So you're pointing out something that's definitely of concern. There are a lot of people in academic medicine and academic circles in general. Most of the presidents, obviously, are not physicians, but who in universities that have medical schools and are very, very concerned about this issue, not only for their own physicians, but are concerned about the availability of physicians to take up the slack and deal with the needs of my generation and others to do something about this. And you can be sure that many of us are using that bully pulpit. Now, the particular gambit you talked about at Mayo Clinic, it's a decision somebody made to do it. It's one way of doing it. There's many other ways of trying to affect an outcome. And I guess what I can tell you is that I'm definitely empathetic and sympathetic with the issue. Many of us are doing the best we can. You continue to do the best you can as well, because as you know, all politics are local, and these decisions are made by people representing folks locally. But I'm with you in concept on this, and please be assured that I have and will continue to work on these issues. Some of the most effective organizations dealing with this, as I'm sure you know, are organizations representing physicians, large numbers of physicians across many municipalities and many states. But certainly the universities that run medical centers, whether or not they own and operate hospitals, have a big stake in this. So I hear you loud and clear, and I'll redouble my efforts to talk about it at a president's meeting that I'm going to in about 6 weeks. So we'll be discussing it, and I appreciate you telling me about it. I also want to thank you for your former generosity to Cornell, and you're also helping us a lot by your good ideas on this phone call, but I'm very, very grateful for the financial generosity that you've shared with us and for your intentions, and thanks for the question.
Thank you, Carol. Karen Brigamonte, would you like to ask a question? Please join us.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
I was wondering what Cornell's role is, whether they are taking any role in influencing the current healthcare debate. And if so, is there any influence in both the quality of healthcare and specifically for both the elderly and the disabled?
It's a terrific question. There's a lot of strengths at Cornell. There's not a school of public health, as you know, but there's a lot of activities on both campuses. I'll tell you a little bit about them off the top of my head, and I'll ask my colleague Tommy to follow up and make sure that we complete the circle, and also to correct any misinformation I'm going to give you right now, because I'm going to do it off the top of my head. In Ithaca, in the College of Human Ecology, is the Sloan program, a program oriented toward health policy. And the head of that program is not a physician, but a faculty member, William White. And they're very much involved in New York and nationally in doing the usual academic approach, which is research and suggesting policies based on their research. At the College of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, there's a very strong department of public health and other people in other departments who work on health policy issues. One such individual that I'll ask Tommy to follow up on, and I hope I get the name right and apologize to the faculty if I mispronounce it, is Lawrence Casolino. Mm-hmm. And I think I got that right, but Tommy will check. And he has written very prominently in the medical literature that probably both you and I have seen. In general, before the very recent push on healthcare reform by President Obama. So many people at Cornell are active and engaged in these things in general. As you know, it's been a huge, huge, and remains a huge political. What can I say to remain sort of nonpartisan on the air here? It's been an area of great interest across both sides of the aisle, right up to the day, right up to the minute. And like many physicians, I'm hoping that there will be some changes that will increase those who have coverage, that will reduce the number of patients that cannot come or choose not to come for medical care of a preventive nature, of the primary care nature that Dr. Bender.
Yeah.
We spoke with before, forgive me for not remembering. And those are areas that I am interested in and doing my best in the local bully pulpit to see that we do participate in this. And Tommy, if you'd be so good as to follow up, there's actually a not too long ago a very interesting article, I believe by Lawrence Castellino, talking about some aspects that need to be faced in healthcare reform. So we're very much part of the discussion on this. The other thing in the state of New York, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Tommy, is I think to this day, if I'm not mistaken, Provost Gatto is the head of the organization of deans of all the medical schools in New York, something like the Associated Medical Schools organization. And they're very active in issues related to healthcare delivery and reimbursement in the state of New York, as well as those related to medical education and research. So thanks for the question, and we'll get some information to you.
Absolutely. I'll follow up after conversation. You just mentioned New York, and you just came from Albany, and you've been very active in Albany working on issues of economic development. I wonder perhaps you could share sort of the latest news that you have from the state capitol.
Well, I'll give a very quick background. The state of New York before the recession got about 20% of its revenue as a state from taxes paid related to Wall Street. And, of course, that's changed enormously in the last 16, 18 months with the Great Recession. So about a year ago, very good advice from Steve Johnson, Cornell University's Vice President for Governmental and Community Relations, advice from the gentleman right here, Tommy Bruce, and Charlie Krasansky, who does our state relations in Albany, we suggested to Governor Patterson, and he very enthusiastically agreed, to set up a task force on trying to diversify the New York State economy based on linkages, interactions, partnerships between industry and colleges and universities in the state of New York. And we learned a lot of interesting things. I won't bore you with the whole story, but one shocking statistic is the over 300 colleges and universities in the state of New York do about $4 billion of research expenditures each year, second only to California in the country, which does about 6.5. That ratio, 4 billion to 6 billion, about two-thirds. But 47% of the venture capital in the United States flows to California and 4% to the state of New York, which is amazing. And so we had a task force, the governor put together himself, of venture capitalists, industrial leaders in the state, college and university presidents. I had the honor of chairing the report, the task force and the report. It's not on our website, but we could send you a link to it if you like. We had some ideas from all the sectors represented and from two public hearings and from about 200 non-solicited inputs about how we can try to take advantage of this enormous research strength in the state of New York and do better for the state economy. One of the biggest sectors in the economy of the state of New York, as everywhere across the country, is healthcare, including both hospitals, individual clinics, the taxes paid by physicians and other healthcare workers. And so in New York, it's on the order of magnitude of 10% of the revenue to the state comes out of the healthcare industry. So that was something we worked on. And in Albany yesterday, I was representing Cornell and also SUNY, since we're attached to the SUNY system, at the beginning of the legislative session.
So I see we were having a couple of questions
Good.
Come in on the chat. The first one, just going to another part of the university, is from Gene Resnick.
Uh-huh.
It says, many of us as Cal's alums have worked with and been very fond of Dean Henry. Can you update us on the search for the next for her successor?
Well, Gene always asks these great questions. So Dean Susan Henry is, I don't know what to call her, a phenomenon. She's in her 10th year, her last year of a hugely successful job as not a manager, but a leader of the, what I consider the top-ranked agriculture and life sciences college in the United States. And all that time, in addition to hugely skillful management of ups and downs and resources, and hiring many, many faculty and keeping us at the very top of the heap, Susan Henry continued high-quality funded research in her area. She's a yeast geneticist, and really she's one of my icons, one of my heroes. She's fabulous, and we're going to miss her sorely. And Provost Kent Fox is working with others on a search for the next dean. I was going to say the replacement, but you can't replace Susan Henry, but the next dean of Cal's. And I don't have any particular data to update you on right this minute, Gene. Tommy will maybe, if he'd be so good, check with Kent Fox, and if there is anything to share, we'll share it. She's going to be very, very sorely missed. Just last week, I was visiting with Dean Henry to celebrate the Gellert family setting up another professorship in Cal's in the Applied Economics and Management program, and we had a chance to begin to honor Susan Henry, not in the way that we will when all is said and done, but what a fabulous member of the Academy, what a fabulous leader, and what a fabulous person.
We have a new question from Fred Ascari, who wants to know what percentage of Cornell's endowment is invested in venture capital. Is any of Cornell's endowment earmarked for venture capital in New York?
Very, very good question. Cornell actually has its own venture fund, the CUGA Venture Fund. And I wonder, Tommy, if you wouldn't mind to send, if I can call you Fred, would a link, I'm not sure if you're on the phone, but we'll start by sending you a link to something on the Internet so that you can learn a bit, as you wish, about the CUGA Venture Fund. We put that money up ourselves. It's managed by faculty and students in the Johnson School and others. And we do invest that money in New York. The endowment is a hugely complicated and is invested in a wide variety of endeavors in liquid assets and less liquid assets in real estate, private equity, many, many other areas. And some of that money, of course, ends up doing the work of venture. But the specific question you're asking is a very, very critical question, and that is, if I can enlarge the question, can universities who have these rich resources, can we invest some of our own funds to try to help close this venture gap between us and, for example, California? And we're doing that. It's one of the main recommendations of the task force, not just Cornell, but the University of Rochester, for example, and others are jumping on the bandwagon to do this. A very, very important question. And Fred, we'll get you some information about the CUGA Venture Fund, and I'd love your feedback after you have a chance to look at that. Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to invite Dr. Larry Reese to ask the question.
Great.
Live. Dr. Reese?
Yes. Hi, President Scorton.
Hi. Thanks for being part of this today.
My pleasure. At a much earlier level, I work with the Cornell Alumni Ambassadors Admission Network, which basically meets with applicants to Cornell Undergraduate School.
Right.
And in South Florida, I'm chairman of our local committee, and we have seen the number of applicants to the undergraduate schools, all seven of them, increase by some 40% this year over last year, which I've attributed a lot of that to the members of our committee that meet with some of these students. We have people that are federal magistrates, physicians like myself, many successful attorneys, veterinarians, and whatnot. And I wondered, realizing the medical school may have their own interview process, but one of the interesting things that have come out of this is to recruit the finest and the brightest minds. Our purpose is basically to speak to these individual applicants and extol the reasons why we chose Cornell and the advantages Cornell has over similar institutions. This has resulted in many students making Cornell their first choice for undergraduate college, and yep. I wonder if it would be a reasonable idea for the medical school to consider a similar program.
First of all, let me thank you a thousand times for what you're doing. I've been overwhelmed in the nearly 4 years that I've been at Cornell now with how effective this particular process is. the combination of this process and the high quality of the faculty and the student experience at Cornell have had our undergraduate applications just going through the ceiling. The year that resulted in the current freshman class, as I know you know, but just to tell the others, we had over 34,000 applications for, what is it, the 3,150 slots in the first-year class. And this year we have over 36,000 applications. And in areas where the ambassadors are very active, as you are, and we thank you again and again for doing that, the percentages are even much higher. So it's been hugely successful for the 700 graduate colleges. It didn't hurt, by the way, as an aside, for us to be named the hottest Ivy. Was that about 18 months ago?
2007.
Yeah, 2007, a couple years ago. Time flies. So that's been terrific. There is a huge oversubscription, if I could use that term, of applicants to Weill Cornell Medical College as well. And I actually don't know, I'm embarrassed to tell you, I don't know whether we have an organized ambassadors network like you're suggesting. I think we do. And if Gene Resnick is still on the phone, Gene would know a chapter and verse about this because of his strong role in the alumni organization for Weill Cornell. Gene, are you still on? Do we have this kind of ambassador network for the medical school?
Hi, yes, I'm still on. We do, in not quite as formalized as the undergraduate ambassadors, which I actually also had participated in with Larry some years ago. There's a strong network of medical alumni around the country that host students coming for interviews and host students coming to look at residency programs locally, so that the alumni network from the medical college is pretty strong. Maybe not developed quite at the admissions level, but certainly as a support mechanism for our enrolled students, it's quite powerful.
Thank you, and thanks for the question, Dr. Rees. But by the way, the reason you're not hearing much from Tommy is he's eating a chocolate chip cookie off camera, and this is really aggravating me. I'm on a weight loss regimen, and it's not helpful that about 18 inches from me, Vice President Tommy Bruce is eating a chocolate chip cookie. Just want to mention that.
I am busted.
Yeah, whatever.
Speaking of the extraordinary increase in and applications.
Yeah, it's breathtaking.
What are your reactions? What are you hearing when you travel around the country and people are exchanging experiences in dealing with Cornell? Do you have any insights that you can share with us
about the admission process
recruitment process in general?
I hear from parents of current students, recently came to Cornell, freshmen, sophomores. I hear from a lot of the parents and from the students. In general, the feedback is positive. I do hear a lot of feedback about the importance of the student experience, Tommy, outside of the classroom, outside of the laboratory, outside of the studio. I hear a lot about the very, very positive reaction to the completion of the North Campus and West Campus residence system. And on the North Campus, faculty and graduate students being in the dorms, and on the West Campus actually having a dean of faculty, a professor, a house dean of each of these houses. And people very, very much, the students and their families, very, very much like this kind of organization. The alumni ambassador network that was mentioned earlier by one of our colleagues is felt to be a hugely positive, helpful, forward-looking, responsive mechanism. I do hear that around the country. I hear a lot of concern about the price of education, and it's very, very understandable. One of our colleagues on this webinar mentioned earlier, and I think it might have been, I'm embarrassed, I can't remember who mentioned, the very high cost of medical education.
Dr. Bender, made a comment about it.
Of course it was. And I went through that myself. It took me 21 years to pay my loans off. It's the best investment, personal investment, my family ever made. But still, the first 21 years, I was paying very, very hefty payments to pay those loans off. So the things that Cornell has done in the last 2 years to reduce, stabilize, and actually reduce the cost of attendance at Cornell is one of the things I'm the most proud of in the last couple of years. And we can talk more about that later if there's no more questions, but I can just summarize it by saying that for three out of the five quintiles of families who demonstrate financial need, Cornell costs less to go to now than it did 10 years ago. So the enormous increase in financial aid is reducing the cost of attendance, not increasing it. Those who are of means such that they fall out of our definition of need, though, are paying much, much more money to go to college now than they were 10 years ago. And, of course, it's the same in the professional schools like Weill Cornell. So clearly we have to do something about attenuating the rate of rise and even reducing the cost structures of these universities. And we're spending a lot of time on that at Cornell on both campuses.
David, you actually spend a lot of time with the students. And
yep.
In fact, every year you live in one of the residence halls for a week. And are you finding that the concerns that students are and the way they experience their educational life is changing dramatically? What are you finding there?
Yeah. We do, Robin and I live in Mary Donlan the first week, orientation week, in the fall when the freshmen first get there, which is a wild week because they're not in classes yet and they don't recognize the difference between day and night, which I still have to come and work with you every day, so I need to recognize that difference. And also, I don't know if I told you this, Tommy, but starting last year and second time this year, we're staying in a West Campus dorm in the spring. Just for a few days, not as long. And so I do have a chance to hear from students. And as Tommy knows, I also have student office hours with Vice President Susan Murphy. And Tommy organizes very skillfully meetings with the Daily Sun editorial board. And I have a column in the Daily Sun, so they're my bosses as well. And so we do hear a lot of things from students. Students are very, very concerned about the cost of education. They're very, very, very concerned about their prospects in this economy for getting a job in any and all fields. And we're redoubling our efforts at career services, redoubling our efforts at trying to urge and exhort the students to apply earlier for employment, to think more broadly than they have in the past. If they can't get their dream job in the for-profit sector, to think about the not-for-profit sector. Cornell is very, very high on the list of schools that send students to Teach for America. We're one of the highest in the Peace Corps for, I think we're classified as medium-sized universities in there. And so students are very, very concerned, as all of us are, for what so far has been a sort of a so-called jobless recovery from this recession. And then finally, the students really, really want to be sure that we return as soon as possible to a healthy pace of faculty hiring, because faculty are retiring from Cornell, and in Ithaca, we have reduced the pace of faculty hiring because of our deficit. That's the kind of things I'm hearing from students.
One of the you might want to give an update, the one of the things that you obviously had to be talking about with students a little bit was the whole H1N1 epidemic on our campus and how things are coming along.
Yeah, we had the great misfortune to lose one of our undergraduates, 20-year-old student, in the fall to H1N1, and we had an enormous number of cases sweeping across the campus, and now it's much, much less. We found, as I'm sure many of those on the call today found, a lot of resistance among college-age people to getting vaccinated. And in fact, we had an op-ed in USA Today exhorting college-age students, college-age people, to get H1N1 vaccinations. Despite that magnificent op-ed, a lot of them didn't get it. So there's still concerns about vaccinations in the United States. And I'm actually curious, since there's not an extant question right now, I wonder if anybody on the phone with us now can share their experience with H1N1 in this population that we deal with. Are your patients, those of you in pediatrics or adolescent care or primary care disciplines, are you having success getting your patients between the ages of, say, 16, 17, and 25 to have H1N1 vaccinations? I'm curious.
Well, while we're waiting for perhaps a comment from our listeners, I mean, it was the dimensions of the situation and at Cornell was Susan Murphy was just recently giving a briefing to the alumni leadership in Washington and had talked about there being something upwards of 1,800 known cases,
wow.
Which means that according to the experts, that's really half of what really took place because
amazing.
The assumption is that 50% of folks did not even consult. But it was quite, just as somebody who was involved in some of the responses to that, it was quite impressive to watch our medical professionals on campus and off the both the quality of the relationships they had developed with the local folks I think that was quite an impressive undertaking.
Yeah, and one of those Saturdays, as I know you know, Tommy, you were so intimately involved. One of those Saturdays, Susan took me on a tour of Gannett Health Center, and there were many, many, many volunteers, student volunteers and staff volunteers, helping to take care of students who stayed in their dorms, who segregated themselves through processes that were developed by Gannett, and it was quite an experience.
I agree. Now, I'm sorry, I wanted to make sure as we have a couple more minutes here before we end this this call to make sure that if there are questions out there that folks want to ask us before we call this particular conversation, bring it to an end. So I'll just wait to hear from you. I think that we plan to continue to do this.
These are terrific.
On a regular basis. I would also like to hear from you all how this particular experience was, because it's our first field. We've been out in the field here. We're at the medical college, and hopefully as David travels, we will continue to do this from different parts of the Cornell world, so to speak.
Would be terrific.
So that we can sort of all get to sort of hear from the various parts of our campus through this mechanism, which I think is why, and just before we close completely, I also want to sort of draw your attention to an expanding amount of activity at Cornell, at what we call CornellCast, which you can get to from cornell.edu. We are now, we have started, I'm happy to report that we have started a weekly interview show with our coaches. It's called Sidelines. You can get to that at 7 p.m. every Tuesday night. We are interviewing the coach of the week. And we will be bringing to you other such interviews with various faculty members and other players on the Cornell campus. We'd love to hear from you as we develop this this outreach tool. People you want to hear from, people you'd like to us to interview live and otherwise through webinars. This has been a great experience. Thank you very much, David.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Thanks everyone for
being
a part of it. And we'll get back to you with a follow up that we promised in the next several days.
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks everyone.
Thank
Have
you.
A good day.
Bye bye.